I think the second phase of the recession happens in the summer. I think it's truncated. I don't think it lasts that long, maybe, you know, 6 months, 6 to 9 months. And then you're going to see stagflation like we have never before seen in this country.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm its founder and your host, Adam Taggart. With the market now expecting less than 2 rate cuts this year, or perhaps none at all until next year, according to Bank of America, what does that mean for the economy? Can it handle higher for even longer interest rates without slowing markedly, or even worse, something systemic breaking? And what impact will these higher rates for longer have on stocks, bonds, and other asset prices? To find out, we're fortunate today to talk with money manager Michael Pento, president of Pento Portfolio Strategies. Michael, my friend, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, it's always a pleasure to be with you, Adam, and we have a lot to talk about today. And some of it isn't that pleasant because I am not happy, and I'll tell you why.
All right. Well, look, who am I to stand between your insights and the audience here? Let's get right into it then. Let me kick it off with the general question I like to toss at you at the beginning of these discussions. What's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
Well, I should make a caveat for the first statement that I made. I'm happy because God has blessed me immensely with a pretty good lifestyle here. So it's not about me. I'm worried about the middle class of this country. Mm-hmm. The government has destroyed, and I use that word in the past tense, destroyed the middle class of the USA. You know, the Fed calls having a fiat currency a tool. Now, I want to ask you, did you ever vote on not backing the US dollar with anything? Did that ever come up for a vote in 1971? Did your dad or your grandpa say, you know what? I think it's a great idea to back the US dollar with absolutely nothing. No.
No, of course not.
It's a rhetorical question. So the Fed has been able to print away every bear market and every recession since 1987. And that has eventually engendered asset bubbles and debt levels that are just, you know, unserviceable and untenable. And when you think about it, there's 12 voting members of the Federal Open Market Committee, 12. Do you think that was by accident? I don't think so. I think they try to imitate that, you know, they're somehow similar to the 12 apostles, and they become like demigods, and they want us to parse Fed statements like we're reading scripture. And let me tell you something, my friend, they're not omniscient. What they really are, in my opinion, is a bunch of feckless politicians. And maybe they're not nefarious in nature, but they're egomaniacs seeking power by any means necessary, holding on to that power. And now, because they've printed away every recession and every bear market, they're now compelled to keep inflation rising to prevent asset bubbles from imploding. They have no other choice, because if they let asset bubbles implode and debt deflation to occur now, it wouldn't be a recession, it would be a depression that we would enter. And they're doing their best to make the government appear solvent, even though it is in fact insolvent. So now they're claiming inflation, and this is the kick, the punchline here. They're claiming inflation is quiescent and monetary policy is tight, even though, and let me give you a list of things that are just counterintuitive to that notion. Credit spreads are tight and they're getting tighter. Financial conditions are easy and they're getting easier. Inflation's above the Fed's 2% target, and that's their warped definition of stable prices. You know, stable prices in my mind and everybody else's mind would be zero inflation. But in the Fed's mind, inflation being stable is 2% inflation, and it's heading further north. So in March, inflation was 3.2% headline CPI, and now it's 3.5%. And here's the thing. You know, the Fed said that they wanted to get back to 2% inflation as fast as possible. But in March, we just lapped March, we're now in April. March marked 3 years of inflation way above the 2% target. Commodity prices. There are 19 commodities in the CRB index. That index alone rose 6% in March. The Wall Street Journal says that food prices are up 37% in the last 4 years, 37%. Buying a home has become unaffordable. Inflation has eviscerated, I said, wiped out the middle class. 78% of Americans now polled say they're living paycheck to paycheck. Yet in this scenario, the Federal Reserve says, hey, everything's good with the monetary policy, and we have to start cutting interest rates and end QT as fast as humanly possible. We're cutting in half, probably starting in March. And the question you should be asking me next is why? Why in the world, given all those facts that I just said, would the Fed seek to bolster the rate of inflation when they're wiping out, or maybe indeed have wiped out, the middle class of America?
Well, tell us, Michael. Go there.
Because the vast swaths of bank, consumer, business, and government debt is unserviceable and untenable at 5% plus borrowing costs. So Powell is pooping his pants right now to get debt level, to get borrowing costs down as fast as he possibly can, because the economy is cycling these debt levels at much higher interest rates, and it just doesn't work. That's the truth.
Okay, so many things to pull into there, my friend. So let's take the last one, because this is a big part of where I wanted to go with you in this discussion. I'm looking for a chart I'm hoping to pull up here. With borrowing costs as high as they are, right? So yields have been rising, right? I think we're at for about 4.65 right now or so on the 10-year treasury.
Yeah. And by the way, when the Fed had a bailout, remember the Bank Term Funding Program? When they first had a bailout, the 10-year note was 3.5%. Now it's 4.6%. A 10-year mortgage was 6.6%. And now it's 7.1%. So, you know, the banks are in big trouble. So I'm sorry, I'll let you answer your question.
No. Great point, which is that things are even worse on the debt burden side, the cost of debt side now than when the bank started failing a year ago. All right. So here's the chart, right? It shows that up until the end of last year, there was a tight correlation between S&P, the price of the S&P, and an inverted chart of the U.S. 10-year, right? So, you know, basically as bond yields went down, asset prices went up. And that correlation is tight, and it's existed for much of the data series extending before this chart here. Now we're seeing, coming into 2021, there's a big divergence between the two, right? And realistically, a divergence shouldn't be able to sustain, because powering higher S&P prices are a sign of optimism, and rising yields are a sign of concern, right? So the question's been being asked, which is, oh, hey, you know, which one of these is right? And what's it gonna take for these lines to start converging? And a lot of people are thinking that, hey, you know what? Like, as yields go up, more and more things threaten to break, and it's gonna have to be stocks that blink, and we're going to have to start to see stock prices readjust. Now, maybe that's what we've started to see in the past couple of weeks in the market, where it dropped 5%. Let me bring up this next chart. So the big question that's been asked is, okay, so like what level interest rates can this economy really handle, right? And Goldman Sachs did a study and basically came out and said 4.8% on the US 10-year is really when the wheels start coming off seriously. And so perhaps it's not that surprising, as we've gotten closer and closer to that key level, that things have gotten a lot more volatile in the markets here. So where I'm going with all this, Michael, is you know, you've just raised some issues about the debt in the banking system being unserviceable at 5%, which of course is what they're challenged to pay, trying to keep up with what folks can get in a money market fund or with a T-bill. You know, do we seem to be approaching some sort of reckoning here where the cost of debt in the system is really starting to break the system itself? Because it sounds like you think that's fear that's driving Powell to think about rate cuts and stopping QT.
Yeah, so that the first chart you showed was the relationship between the 10-year note and the S&P 500. So I look at something called risk premium. So if you take the inverse of the PE ratio, that's that means the earnings yield of stocks, right? That gives you an earnings yield of around 4.7, 4.8%. But I can get 5.3% in a risk-free T-bill. So another way of saying what you just said in the showed in that chart is that you're getting paid more by owning a risk-free T-bill than you are in buying stocks. This is very rare. This is the last time this happened was 2002, I believe. So this is a very rare event where the risk premium for stocks is negative. Do you follow that?
I do, and the logic of where that's going to go, and please elaborate on this, is, hey, if I can get the same return where I've got seniority, on the claims for the company, and I've got a greater degree of safety, like why wouldn't I just buy the bond and not the stock?
Yeah. So and that's using their ultra optimistic forward guess on earnings. It still isn't worth it. That's why I have 60%, some odd 60% of my portfolio is in what they call risk-free short-term treasury bonds, treasury notes to be specific, not really T-bills, but notes. So I'm out in the 1 to 3 year treasury note. But more to your point, I mean things you're thinking about is how much debt really is out there. So it drives me crazy. I still hear people on mainstream financial media talk about how wonderful the consumer is doing and the consumer has no debt, blah, 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 blah. Well, consumer debt is at an all-time record high. There's $20 trillion of consumer debt. That's up from $15.6 trillion in 2019. 40% of the Russell 2000 is unprofitable. Corporate debt is now $13.7 trillion, up 100% since 2007. Record 49% of GDP. Corporate defaults have soared by 80% since 2023. $1.8 trillion have to be refinanced by 2025. There's a record $1.3 trillion of credit card debt. Delinquency is up 100% since 2021, highest on record. Auto loan delinquencies are the highest in a decade. And as I mentioned before, 78% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. Now, there's something called, I'm just going to, I'm creating a scenario to show you how much debt there is outstanding and why it's just not serviceable. It may be at 0.3% when the 10-year note was 0.3, but not at 5.25. So private credit, which are loans to businesses who can't get a loan from a bank or issue corporate debt, that was $100 billion pre the global financial crisis. Now it's $1.7 trillion.
Whoa.
The government has $1 trillion in interest payments in 2025. In 2007, the total debt was $160 billion. Now we're paying $1 trillion just in interest payments. Of course, we know 100, it's 123.5% total debt to GDP. It was 60% of GDP in the global financial crisis. The national debt is 733% of our revenue. And we're adding to that over 40% every year because of our debt and deficits. A fifth of all of our revenue is spent on interest payments. These are all facts I'm giving you. This is why Powell, I call him, Powell is pooping his pants. I like it, the alliteration there. He's pooping his pants. And he's out there doing this shtick. He's like, oh, inflation's coming down, but it's going to be bumpy and lumpy and schmumpy. No, Powell. Inflation isn't coming down. It's been above 2% for 3 years. It's going higher away from 2%, and it's going away from 2% at a faster rate. So who are you? I mean, how much longer are you going to lie about this? Here's where the rubber meets the road, because I manage money for a living. You're lying about this in the hopes that someday soon you're going to get your wish. You can say, oh, he'll get this great inflation print. Wow, we're closer to 2%. I can start cutting rates. But at 3.5% headline CPI, and with home prices out of reach and asset prices at record levels, how much do you think he's going to be able to cut before he, sends the dollar crashing and inflation up even further? And there's one more thing I just have to mention. There's a good chance, this is the first time really since 1981 that the Fed's going to be cutting rates when we have an inflation problem.
Right.
What happens if they cut rates and end QT and go back into QE and restart the bank term funding program and maybe get rid of the reserve requirement, the capital rate ratio requirement for banks? What if they do all this stuff and guess what? Long-term rates soar.
Right.
They've solved nothing. Nothing.
All right, Michael. So much of I want to react to on that. So there's been a lot of debate. I think it's clear to me what side you're on in terms of whether Powell's December policy pivot, verbally at least, hey, we're going to do rate cuts, what was due to confidence, right? That, hey, I've really got this under control, or that it was due to fear. I think I hear from you, hey, it's due to fear, right? You know, we've got a system that is buckling under these current high cost of debt. But he's got inflation that's been, you know, stymieing him, right? It's proving stickier than he wanted. Let me ask you this, because you made that comparison to the 70s. Now, Powell has essentially said many times he doesn't want to be an Arthur Burns. He wants to be a Volcker. Does he have a choice, I guess, is my question here. So there are people that say that we're now in an era of fiscal dominance, which when you are basically in periods of fiscal dominance, the Fed gives up its inflation fighting mandate because it prioritizes servicing the debt over everything else. It sounds like you think maybe we may already be there.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind we're there. It's not only that we have, you know, as I said, 40% of the Russell 2000 is unprofitable. You're talking about mass bankruptcies in corporate America and mass bankruptcies on the consumer level and the government being insolvent if they were to pursue a policy of higher for longer. They really wanted to get inflation down to 2% and keep it there. I think they risk having a depression, not a recession.
Okay, so
absolutely clear in my answer there.
No
equivocation.
On the day we're talking, the day before, Bank of America came out and said, hey, we don't think we're likely to get a rate cut at all this year. We probably won't get the first rate cut until 2025. Assume for a minute that happens. Do you see the system breaking somewhere before we would get to 2025?
Yes, I do. I think Powell at best, as I said, he's not omniscient by any means. He's a feckless politician. And he's in the charge of keeping banks solvent or trying to make them as solvent as possible or appear that way. And by de facto measure, also the government. So I think he's going to be able to cut rates at best once before the election. He will cut QT, the pace in QT, in half as well. And that's my prediction. I think that is going to be woefully inadequate to stop the recession from coming. And I think we're going to have an air pocket sometime around whenever the reverse repo facility money is withdrawn. We have about $400 billion left there. That's QE, which is offsetting the QT, and then some by about $500 billion in the past year. I think that runs dry around June or July. And when that happens, you're going to have a problem in the repo market. We're going to keep cycling these interest rates through the banking system and through consumers and through corporations. And I think you end up with an air pocket in asset prices sometime in the summer.
Okay.
That will cause Powell, and he's demonstrated to this to me over and over again, that he's like a bully talking tough on a playground about inflation. He talks very tough about fighting inflation, but when the rubber meets the road, he will not hesitate to make Bernanke blush at how much money he will print and how fast he will cut rates.
Okay, so much to get into, and I definitely going to put a pin in the market correction. We'll get to your thoughts on that in just a minute. So you said this is all proceeding to what you believe will be a fall into recession for the economy. If that happens on the trajectory you think it may, is that going to be a disinflationary recession or a stagflationary recession?
It's going to start out as a disinflationary recession, in my opinion, and end up as a stagflationary recession in response to what the Fed is going to do. You know, by the way, we already had a recession in manufacturing and in S&P 500 earnings, and in most asset prices, stock and bonds. So manufacturing sector contracted for 16 out of the last 17 months. We had four straight quarters of year-over-year earnings growth that was negative. And the Russell 2000 fell by 35% from the end of 21 to October of 23. So we've already had a recession, but we're going to have another one. We're still headed for another recession or part two of the recession that started in 2022 and the end of 21, 22. Gross domestic income plummeted, by the way, in 2022 mm-hmm. as well for a while. So I think it's going to be a truncated recession. It will be combated by measures that Powell will take as far as slashing the Fed funds rate back towards zero, below 2%, in my opinion. He will relaunch the Bank Term Funding Program. I don't think the standing repo facility or the discount window is going to be enough to ameliorate the plunge in asset prices, in particular commercial real estate and mortgage-backed securities. So, yeah, okay. I'm predicting a truncated recession.
Okay. So bear with me on this because I want to pull a bunch of details out of you. So you were talking about inflation and the inflation challenges that Powell is facing here, and that if he eases, it'll make the inflation problem worse. But it sounds like in the nearer term, meaning the next couple quarters, you think we're going to enter a disinflationary recession. So is it correct to say that the lag effect of these higher interest rates will win out in the short term, sending us into a disinflationary recession? Then you expect that the policy response, and I'm not just going to leave it to the Fed, because I'm pretty sure we've opened the door to fiscal rescues now with what we did during COVID. I imagine that you think, and correct me if I'm wrong, it'll be twin cannons of both monetary rescue stimulus and fiscal rescue stimulus that will make this a truncated recession, because they're just going to be blasting those stimulus guns full bore.
I had my doubts about the fiscal response before January of 25. There's just no way you're going to get a massive round of helicopter money getting through both houses of Congress. I just don't see it happening.
Even if we fall into a recession?
Yes, I okay. do.
Yeah, and why is that? Just because they're at log jams, or
yeah, I don't think the Republicans are going to go out of their way to rescue Joe Biden before the election.
Okay, and I just to argue the other side for a second, do you think Republicans wouldn't be they wouldn't want to be seen as not providing relief to the average American during a recession, right when there's an election happening?
My confidence level isn't, 1,000% here, Adam. My experience, and I've been in business for 33 years. I think politics trumps the electorate in the short term, not in the long term, but in the short term. So I think the Republicans will be reticent to give Biden a bailout before the election. So you'll have an air pocket there, say between July and January of 25, where there's not much done. If they're going to do something, and this is why I say that. I mean, this is the first time where you can actually say that the country's insolvent. I mean, this is an insolvent nation, which threatens to have $6 trillion in deficits, $6 trillion in deficits in the next recession. I mean, how much helicopter money do you really think that you're going to get passed? So the Powell will do what he can. There might be some window dressing around the edges, but multiple $1 trillion helicopter money drops like they did it post COVID. It just post the COVID breakout. It's just not going to happen. And that's what's necessary. You can't. Bernanke, just to refresh your memory, Bernanke took interest rates, started cutting rates in the summer of 2007. Tinkering and tankering around, 25, 50 basis points here. It wasn't until March of 2009 that the recession ended. And he got to zero by December of 2008. So, I mean, you need massive interest rate reductions and some combination of QE and maybe some targeted fiscal stimuli, helicopter money, i.e. helicopter money, to bring the economy out of its death spiral, because that's where the economic gravity wants to take this. I mean, asset prices have no business being where they are. The home price to income ratio is 5.5. My data that I just pulled out from the NAR and the Census Bureau. So I mean, that's the latest data. It was 2.8. That ratio is 2.8 in the year 2000.
Yeah.
Home price is just not supportable. They're not, it's not a viable market. It's an illiquid market. The transaction market is frozen and home prices are unaffordable. If you look at total market cap of equities as a percentage of GDP, 188% it was last week, 188%. If you look at historically speaking, that's unprecedented before COVID. Totally unprecedented.
Right. We got above 200 during COVID, but that was exceptional. And 188 is still bananas. All right. So we're going to get to the market correction potential in just a bit. But let me, I want to make sure your outlook is as clear as possible for the viewers. So you think that the lag effect of higher interest rates sends us into a disinflationary recession at some point this year. The Fed may start reacting to that at some point this year. Congress likely not, given the reasons you mentioned to us. So let's say we go into 2025 and the Fed is doing what it can. The fiscal side hasn't kicked in yet. My question here is regards the lag effect, which I talk about all the time. So we've been sitting here at high interest rates, relatively high interest rates, you know, compared to recent history, for a good while now. And so my question is if we slip into this recession, you know, the Fed pulls a policy lever, there's a lag effect on it, even if it's trying to stimulate, right? So it could take a long while before we see the impact of the Fed stimulus in the economy. Yes, it might stimulate some interest rate sensitive asset prices, but in terms of getting the average person to feel like things are getting better, that could take an awfully long while. So A, do you agree with that? And then B, does fiscal stimulus kick in 2025 once the election's in the rearview mirror?
Yeah. So yes, interest rates work with a lag. Everybody knows that. That's clear. I use that example of Bernanke cutting rates in the summer of 2007 and did absolutely nothing to help or ameliorate the plunge in the stock market or the plunge in home prices, down 33%. So
yeah, and sorry, I just want to talk to this chart real quick, which is exactly what you're saying, which is when we go into recessions like this, I mean, using history as a guide, the Fed usually keeps rates too high for too long and then realizes, oh gosh, we need to really start stimulating. And they just scramble to cut rates and then a recession ensues that can last, you know, a year or more.
Mm. And here's the problem. So you say like fiscal policy kicks into high gear come sometime in 2025. That is not a prescription for a healthy economy. That is a prescription for stagflation. And you know, and I know I'm not telling you anything. I mean, how do you grow an economy? A healthy economy is you save a lot of money, and then the private sector deploys those assets out, lends them out. And the private sector buys capital and uses ingenuity and inventions to increase productivity. That is how you grow an economy. You do not grow an economy by monetizing government debt. That is how you create stagflation. And history is unequivocally positive, if I can say that word and not stutter. It is 100% positively 100% sure that is the way you destroy the middle class and an economy.
So after we talk about the market stuff, I do want to get into the destruction of the middle class with you, because I think that is becoming, I think, sort of the persistent theme of my videos here, is shining an ever brightening light on that reality, right? And I don't think that ends anywhere good. I don't think you do either. So maybe we can hopefully have a little bit of time to dig into that specifically in a bit. You know, you I think rightfully railed on our central bankers here at the Fed. Michael, you may not have seen this, but I did what I think is a really significant interview a few weeks back with Thomas Honig, who ran the Kansas City Fed, and then was a sitting member of the FOMC coming out of the Great Financial Crisis. Yeah. You may already know this, but he was the lone dissenting voice on the FOMC when Bernanke was trying to get a universal vote, a unanimous vote for QE. So I think Honig set the record for the longest string of dissents on the FOMC against that, for all the reasons that you would say, right? So it was a fascinating interview. He was a very genteel, calmly spoken man. He answered every question I asked him. And sadly, I left the interview feeling like all the concerns that you and I have about how decision-making happens at the Fed, it's every bit as bad as you and I would think it would be. And at the end, you know, I asked him about, he's very concerned about the growing wealth inequality. A lot of that's just rooted in the fact that our monetary and fiscal policies goose financial assets, so they benefit the wealthy. And then we're destroying the purchasing power of the currency, which disproportionately hurts those that don't own assets, right? So he's very concerned about that. So when I asked him, you know, okay, so where's the hope in the story? What's it going to take to get us on a better trajectory? Because he himself said, hey, status quo gets us to a destroyed dollar, a destroyed middle class, all that stuff. So I said, you know, what helps us avoid that fate? He said, oh, well, you know, we have to get our fiscal house in order. More than anything else, we got to get the fiscal side in order. I said, great. Okay, what are the odds of that? He said, current cast of characters, zero. Right? So depressing. But he did agree. I asked him, I said, how big of a Pandora's box did we open with the direct-to-household fiscal stimulus during COVID? And he said, a massive one. Can't be overemphasized. And so he fears, as I think you and I do, that, as you said, it's not a recipe for a healthy economy, but he fears that is now a go-to response to any, you know, economic crises that we have, is that the policymakers will turn to it because it makes them look popular, and the constituency will demand it. Hey, you gave it to us last time, give it to us this time, give us more.
Yeah, I mean, Honig is Mr. Honig is much more affable and gregarious than I am. by a lot.
You are both. You're both affable and gregarious.
Well. Thank you for that. But I agree 100% with him. I don't think there's really much of a choice. The choice, they do have a choice. I mean, we all human beings with free will, but the choice is depression or hyperinflate. That's your choice, because you know if just like home prices. If home prices were 5% inflated and we had a recession, or if the total market cap of equities was 90% of GDP, not 188% of GDP, then you have some leeway there. You can have a mild recession. If the consumer didn't have $20 trillion in debt and there wasn't these exotic derivatives outstanding, then you could have a slight recession. It wouldn't be so bad. It'd be cathartic and you could bounce back rather quickly. But when asset prices and debt levels have become so detached from reality, having a recession will quickly devolve into a depression. And having the market forces apply, in other words, home prices, in my view, have to come down 40%. Equity prices have to come down 40% so they can be back to historical relationships. And having that happen will wipe out the consumer, wipe out pension plans, and wipe out the banking system. Now, you could have that happen, and it would be a depression would ensue for a few years. That's not unheard of in this country, by the way, but it would be a rather severe one, probably even worse than the Great Depression. But then on the other side of that, you can have a viable economy. Alternatively, you can pursue this never-ending pursuit of inflation. And what you're going to get is, and I call it past tense, an evisceration. The middle class has been already eviscerated. You'll have the very wealthy, a few very wealthy, lots of poor people, and an existential crisis for the United States of America as a world power. That's your alternative. Those are your choices. Pick it. Pick and choose.
Yeah. All right. So just to cut to the punchline, Do you think we are going to choose the better of those routes proactively? Or do you think we're going, if we do, it's going to be forced on us by some crisis that we just keep?
What did Winston Churchill say? You know, the U.S. always does the right thing after they exhausted every, and I'm butchering his quote, but we always do the right thing after we've done everything wrong. So
right. After we've exhausted every other potential option. Yeah, it's a great quote. And okay, so you're more in that camp.
Yes, I am.
Okay, all right. And just to show my cards, I am too, human nature being what it is. And honestly, just, I think they've given us plenty of evidence that that's the route they're going to go.
Can I just, before you ask your next question, and yeah. You're one of the best, if not the best interviewers on the planet. But before you go in another direction, I want to make sure we put some meat on the bones here. So people, I don't like click porn or, you know, financial porn, whatever they call it. I always want to come out. You know, I think about managing money from this standpoint. How can I best serve my clients? Does that mean I should always be long bonds, always be long gold, always be long this? No, always do nothing but the best thing for your clients. And to arrive at the right conclusions, you have to objectively analyze the data. Mm-hmm. So I want to just put some meat on the bones as far as what, you know, why do I think that we have a recession in the card? So first of all, the index of leading economic indicators has been down 21 of the last 22 months. The National Federation of Independent Small Business Optimism Index has been down for, and has been spent 27 consecutive months below the 50-year average, and that is of 98. Household net interest income has dropped by $200 billion in this current Fed tightening cycle. Because this tightening cycle, consumers have more floating rate debt, and much more of their savings is in dividend stocks, dividend producing income, not bonds. Remember, now when bonds yielded nothing, they sold bonds and bought stocks, and that maintained itself for a long time. So they're actually, and this is a study not done by Michael Pinto and company, a study was done by Bloomberg, $200 billion in a loss of net income. The 10-year note minus the 2-year note yield is now in the longest inversion in history, and it has a near perfect recession predictor since 1955. There's one exception, 1965. The economy didn't hit a recession that time, but GDP dropped from 10% to 0.2%. We've had a positive real Fed funds rate for the past 12 months, and every time it's been positive for about a year, about a year since the year 2000, we've had a recession. Personal and corporate bankruptcies are soaring. It's up 19 months in a row. Corporate defaults are the most since Q1 of 2021. And bank lending and money supply growth are contracting. So those are some of the examples of why I say that a recession was held in abeyance by the emptying of that $2.5 trillion in the reverse repo facility. Think of that as $2.5 trillion of quantitative easing, which more than offset the $1 trillion in quantitative tightening, $1.5 trillion in quantitative tightening. I think the second phase of the recession happens in the summer. I think it's truncated. I don't think it lasts that long, maybe, you know, 6 months, 6 to 9 months. And then you're going to see stagflation like we have never before seen in this country.
Wow. All right. Well, look, you know, I was thinking of snidely responding, but hey, Michael, despite all that, you know, why worry? We got strong GDP growth. We got, you know, near record low unemployment, and we got, you know, markets still near all time highs, right? And the analogy that comes to my mind is, I live out here in California. We've got a long coastal highway, and due to coastal erosion, sometimes what happens is all the ground underneath the highway gets eroded, but the asphalt still remains, right? So it looks fine up until the point something too heavy drives over just the asphalt and there's nothing supporting it and you fall into the sinkhole, right? Is that a good analogy for kind of where we are right now, where people can kind of look at the main indicators and say, what are you worried about?
Yeah, many of my writings have pointed to, I liken the actions of monetary policy as a torrent under a foundation. So you're eroding the soil under a foundation, and then all of a sudden the home collapses. So you're exactly spot on correct.
Yeah, great minds think alike. Thank you. All right. So so when you say stagflation, at which we can't even yet conceive, is that largely due to stagflation from the inflation from the policy response? So we're still stuck in recession, but the policy response is just boosting the price of everything.
Yeah, I mean, inflation isn't an accident, and inflation sure as heck doesn't come from too many people becoming productive. You know, the Fed has all their models are garbage. The Phillips curve is just ridiculous. So inflation is a deliberate act on the part of a government. It usually occurs when a central bank monetizes out of control government debt. And what you're doing is you're destroying the confidence in a fiat currency's purchasing power. That is inflation. And it's usually the direct result of a central bank monetizing out of control government debt. And that's exactly where we'll be. And our starting point is from insolvency and inflation. It's not starting from solvency and deflation, like we've been in every instance since 1981. It's starting out from insolvency. It's starting out from, you know, a $2 trillion deficit. It's starting out from $1 trillion in interest payments. It's starting out when 700 and your interest payments, I'm sorry, your deficit, the total debt outstanding, let me be clear, the total deficit outstanding is 700% of your revenue. It's just not a viable situation. You are going to destroy what's ever left of the confidence in the dollar, not against the euro or the pound or the yen or the renminbi, against hard assets. You are going to destroy that confidence completely. Because let me ask you this. This is not a rhetorical question. Who do you think, what investors out there are still going to believe the Fed has the ability to bring inflation under control if they are forced to resort to ZERP and QE when inflation is 60% above its target?
Right. So then do you expect the bond vigilantes to return here and push up the long end of the bond curve?
I think the chances of that are extremely high this time around. And that is very dangerous because the mollifying effect of lowering short-term rates, the Fed controls short-term rates. They do not control long-term rates. That's a function of supply and demand and inflation. And the supply is going to be a tsunami of debt. Like I said, $6 trillion in deficits. So you're going to have the Fed monetizing all of that debt. And you're going to destroy the purchasing. The confidence in our dollar is going to be totally wiped out, in my opinion, if that happens.
So does this begin to lead us on the path on the Fed increasingly pushing on a string where it's just doing everything that it can do, but like rates don't come down, maybe go higher eventually. And so, you know, the Fed no longer has as much, if any, control to manage cost of debt in the economy.
Well, they can force banks to, you know, primary dealers to force them to buy long-term debt. They can buy long-term debt. They can do some, you know, yield curve twisting. They can do a lot of things. But the bottom line is that real interest rates will plummet because the Fed will try to cap interest rates. Short-term they control, long-term they do not, but they can try to force them lower, but inflation rates will soar. So when you cap long-term rates and the rate of inflation soars, you're having a plunging real interest rate. And that's all that matters when it comes to investing. What is the real interest rate? And that's all that matters when it comes to gold too. That's not all, but that's most of what matters when it comes to gold. Yes, geopolitical strife matters completely. That the US wants to usurp currency reserves, you know, the trade deficit, trade surpluses are parked in our bond market and our dollar, and then the United States might tell Russia, China, Venezuela, Brazil, you don't have those currency reserves any longer. They're ours. So then the calculation is, hey, maybe, I think like Venezuela did today, that wait, you know, maybe we'll park our currency reserves or trade in oil using Bitcoin and hopefully gold instead of US dollars. So that you're losing that tailwind of the world's reserve currency status But most of all, what gold loves more than anything is falling real interest rates. And if the Fed is, that's where they're, this is their, if the Fed is telling you, and this is why I think the main reason why gold is, thank you for asking me that question. I don't think you did, but hopefully you were going to go there. What's the behind the big bull market in gold? Is that the Fed is like closing their eyes and they're holding their nose like, inflation is under control. It's doing fine. It's lumpy, but it's going back to 2%. Trust us, even though it went from 3.2 to 3.5, it's going in the right direction. We'll get there soon, even though commodity prices are surging and home prices are going up again. And asset prices are rising out of control, but the inflation is fine. Don't worry, it's quiescent. We got it under control. And gold saying, wait a second, you're going to ignore that. Then real interest rates are falling. And that's when you have to own gold.
Okay. All right. Well, look, let's get to the meat of the issue then, where the rubber meets the road. How does a money manager like you, who has clients whose wealth he has to steward, how does he position for what you see ahead? I think you maybe already shared the punchline of your market outlook. I heard you say that the markets are, stocks are 40% higher than they should be if they were at fair value. I think I heard you right. Does that mean that as we slip into recession, you expect a correction of that size? And if so, whatever, what is your market your model telling you right now? Because we've spent a lot of time on your past appearances describing the 20-point model that you use and the fact that even though you have a lot of macro inclinations about what might happen in the future, you use the discipline of the model to really try to help you own what is most likely to do right for the period of time that we're in.
Right. So so the model predicted that we'd be in inflation following the COVID crisis. Then I predicted the model predicted disinflation going from 9% back towards 3-4%. Then we've been the last few quarters in a condition of reflation. I think the next salient sector would be one of disinflation, as I mentioned before, as the reverse repo facility runs dry and a lot of this debt gets recycled at higher and higher rates, it's going to be more and more recessionary. We should slip back into disinflation. And then finally, we hit stagflation. And with the model has five sectors ranging between deflation and intractable inflation or intractable stagflation. I think that's eventually where we end up, which is in sector five. And when you think about investing, it's nuances like this. Like most investors, most of Wall Street are salespeople. So, and I know your approved advisors are not salespeople. They're very intelligent people with models. So, but most of Wall Street is not that way. They will take this target date fund and say, buy stocks and bonds and some mix. Well, what we've done in Penta Portfolio Strategies, and we've done this for a long time, is we've eschewed long-term interest rates. So all of our holdings on bonds, which are substantial, it's about 60%, are in either, they were in T-bills, but now we've moved out as rates moved higher. We moved all the way into the 1 to 3 year duration treasuries. We're not going far out in duration. We're not owning zero coupon bonds or anything like that, or not even the TLT, 20 year plus, because I think there's a salient risk of, you might have a rally there short term, but because of the response from the Federal Reserve, we just talked about the dangers of having long-term rates run, you know, intractable. So I'm staying mostly in the short term, but as we go towards stagflation, I will sell all the bonds in the portfolio and I'll concentrate things like precious metals, overweighting in precious metals. Right now we're about a 13% stake. I could raise that all the way to 20% in stagflation, agricultural commodities, soft commodities, hard commodities, base metals and energy would be primary holdings in the portfolio. Don't forget, and this is very important, and you touched on a great question, because you are a great question. Do I think that the market's going to drop 40%? I think the market should drop 40%. I think if the market forces were allowed to play out, equity prices would plunge by 40%. I think home prices would also go to 40% debt to the downside. Do I think that's going to happen? Without a lot of resistance from fiscal and monetary policy? No, I don't. So I think that we're going to have stagflation, and I hate to repeat myself, but stagflation, the likes of which never before imagined it could happen in the United States. You know, I remember, and I just want to get this out. I remember when I first got into the business in the early 90s, and Richard Fisher, Dallas Fed, was interviewed one time, and he said, You know, the United, and he's a great man, so I'm not disparaging him in any way whatsoever. But he said, you know, the United States is the greatest country on the planet, and it, in many ways it still is. We will never run, comparing the United States to Zimbabwe or the Hungarian Pango or, you know, Weimar Germany. We will never run deficits in the trillions of dollars that will be monetized by the Senate. Never. This was in early 90s. Lo and behold, just a few decades later, this is exactly what we've done. We've monetized about $5 trillion of the $6 trillion in helicopter money deployed just since COVID. Central bank's balance sheet went from $700 billion in 2007 to $9 trillion. This is base money supply. So yes, the United States is not immune from the forces of economics and markets. And this is exactly where I think we're headed. Unbelievable, eye-popping stagflation and a further destruction of whichever left of the middle class. Unfortunately, because the other choice is a depression, and that's not politically tenable.
Okay. All right. So right now you are hanging out in pretty short duration U.S. treasuries. You've got some exposure to commodities, energy, gold. Presumably, if we get into a deflationary recession, disinflationary recession, you'll get closer to sort of those you know, four horsemen that we've talked about a lot. And folks, just to be real quick, that's if I remember correctly, it's T-bills, it's U.S. dollar instruments, it's gold hard cash, and it's shorts. And shorts highly selectively deployed based upon what you see at that moment in time. All right. So
by the way, can I just add something? Shorting the high yield market with these record tight spreads should do very well for, and again, this is not an investment advice. You have to talk to your advisor and see if you're qualified for it, but shorting high yield should be a big winner in the next recession.
Okay. And do you have any high yield shorts on yet? Or is that not until your model tells you? You do. Okay.
Certainly do. The only short I have right now, which is a straight out short in the market, is high yield debt. And by the way, it has not worked for us.
And are you doing that by just like shorting a high yield ETF, or are you doing a spread type of thing?
Since I'm a fiduciary and I have a lot of retirement accounts, I own an ETF that goes up when high yield spreads blow out to treasuries.
Okay. So it is an inverse ETF for the spread. Okay. All right. So we'll see what happens. And Michael, as your model tells you that we're progressing into the next phase, please raise your hand. We'll have you back on the channel and you'll tell our audience in real time how you might be tweaking your current positioning. But let's get to this future of eye-popping stagflation, right? You've talked, and I agree with you very much so, about how the middle class is really getting decimated, I mean, in real time right now. Obviously, eye-popping stagflation is just going to make that even worse, right? I mean, are we, like, I do want to try to end with whatever hope you see in the story here, but, like, I mean, are we kind of on a collision course with a banana republic style social strata where you have just a very few people that kind of own it all, and everybody else that's basically been pushed out of the ladder to prosperity?
Well, I don't even want to answer your question. I really don't. This is the first time you asked me. I don't even want to answer. I mean, it's such a sad response that I have. And the United States is resembling more and more of a banana republic. Multiple trillion-dollar deficits, $1 trillion in interest payments, insolvent treasury market. Politically speaking, you know, and here I got a lot of bad emails after I said this, and I am not a supporter. I am not a member of the Republican Party. You know, trying to jail a potential candidate, a leading candidate and an ex-president, is usurping the desire of the choice of American citizens to vote who they want to put in office. That's what you do in banana republics. Those kind of debt and deficits are what happens in banana republics. And that's where we're, and that's where I think we're headed, unfortunately.
Well, I'm sad and sorry for that honest answer. And again, I wrestle with this going forward. And folks, while Michael and I are talking about a trend, you know, we're talking about averages, and obviously the opportunity here for the individual is to have control and agency over your own destiny. And of course, that's what we're trying to do here on this channel, Thoughtful Money, and why this is what Michael's trying to do with his clients, is we're trying to get as many people as possible educated about what's going on so they can make more informed decisions and position themselves to be less vulnerable and maybe even potentially profit from some of these unfortunate trends that are going on. So Michael, I wanted to return to some stats that you mentioned. It's something like 70% of Americans report living paycheck to paycheck. The amount of income that it takes to buy the median house in America has risen by 45% since 2020, right? 40% of renters are saying that they feel they'll never be able to buy a house. That's up from 20% just 1 year ago. And Michael, I just want to show you this one thing before you respond, just to really get your blood boiling here. Bear with me for 1 second because it's not coming up. Let me pull it up here. So this is an example of increasingly where I think we're headed. Like, I keep talking about how sadly America seems to be losing its status as a meritocracy, where anybody from any background has a shot at a better tomorrow and grasping the brass ring and living the American dream. And I think it's increasingly becoming an aristocracy, where your odds for doing that are directly tied to how wealthy your parents were, for the most part. Yeah. But look at this, okay? Here's a headline from the Wall Street Journal last week, right? I'm going to read it just for those that are listening on a podcast. It says, they love their $15 million Hamptons house. The problem, their dog hates it.
Oh, so you can, most of Americans can identify with that. Come on, right?
Yeah, come on. Well, listen to this. So this couple built their dream house in Sag Harbor, but are now selling it because their golden doodle Rufus gets, quote, pouty when he's there, right? So who knows? Maybe there's some other real reason why they're selling the house. But I mean, come on. You have this rarefied life of the elites where, you know, their biggest issues in life is that their, you know, expensive breeder dog, you know, has mildly less energy when he's at their $15 million vacation home, right? Versus all those stats I read earlier about, like, you know, a good part of the country saying, I'm never going to be able to afford any house.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the cost of the house. What you didn't mention was the cost to insure the house.
The cost of home ownership.
The cost of home ownership is not just the cost of the home, it's to insure the house and to pay taxes on the house.
You know, and to do maintenance.
I live in Florida, and maintenance, exactly. I live in Florida. I got a bill for my home. I did not change the home in any fashion at all. I didn't make any huge improvements. So the price of the home actually went down about $100,000. About 5%. Guess what? My insurance went up 70%, 70%, with no claims. So, you know, it's not just the cost of the house, not just the 5.5 times income, family income, median incomes. It's the insurance and the taxes. And what are you hearing from our Federal Reserve? What are they doing to protect the middle class and low, and I am not in the middle class. I'm in the 1%, and so I am not feigning faking to be a rich guy. But I care more about people, the middle class, America. And at some point it has to stop, because it's not sustainable. You it leads to civil unrest eventually, and now you don't want that. Nobody should want that. I'm not talking about an egalitarian socialism here. I'm saying let the market work. Does anybody believe in markets anymore?
That is a great question. And I think I'm going to have to start wrapping it up on that as an open question, because it really deserves, I think it's a full interview, really just rolling up our sleeves and digging into that. And Michael, even to the extent of whether our current crop of leaders are going to reverse course and start doing the things that we think they should. I'm not going to hold my breath for that, but I'd love to have the discussion with you on what other reforms we'd like to see, right? If there was a conscientious politician watching our videos, you know, can we give them, you know, ideas for a policy platform that that we and maybe a lot of the viewers here could rally around, right?
May I, and I know I don't want to go long. I just want to say one thing. How about making the supply of money and the cost of that money more a function of market forces, the supply of savings versus demand for money, rather than the 12 apostles who decide through their omniscient and benevolent, you know, demigod status, what the cost of money should be and how much there should be a base money supply, which is Fed credit and physical currency and coins in circulation.
I am right there with you, buddy. And what was interesting is Thomas Hoenig, you know, who basically ran a regional Fed and was on the FOMC, he agrees. You know, he basically points to going off the gold standard. And he says, look, I'm not necessarily a champion of the gold standard. It has its own limitations. But he said it removed the constraint, the limiter on the system. And the only limiter became, you know, humans' proclivity to restrain themselves, which we all know isn't very good. Right. Yeah. So I'm right there with you, brother.
It doesn't have to be gold. I mean, you could just, why gold? Because mine supply of gold increases about 2% per annum, and that's commensurate with long-term GDP growth, which is a population or labor force growth plus productivity. That, you know, something that makes sense other than, well, you know, it looks like the market's suffering here and it looks like we might have a recession. So let's print a few $1 trillion and give it to the banks to loan to the government.
So I'm right there with you. And I just want to underscore here for all of us that are cheering this, which is we as a populace need to embrace the other side of that coin, which is, hey, when recessions happen, we have to let them play out, right? We have to let the bust part of the cycle play out. And I think it's been a huge part of what's been going on here is that the central planners have been trying to make it an eternal boom, right? And so to have a market-driven system or a system that has sustainable constraints on it, you have to take the downside along with the good. And I'm all for that. But in the moment, you know, during a recession when people lose their jobs or are having trouble, you know, struggling to pay their bills, you have to kind of realize that that's a necessary part of a healthy system as long as it doesn't last, you know, too long. And so we as a populace, you know, we have the proclivity to vote for whoever's offering us immediate relief. We need to get out of that and we need to elect leaders and give them the mandate to say, do whatever it takes to keep it sustainably healthy as opposed to, you know, answering our every wish.
Adam, and I love you dearly, you know that, but I mean, how many people really would understand what we're talking about? What percentage of the population really would understand the fact, well, yeah, I understand why we need a depression for a little while.
But we used to have leaders that would do fireside chats and explain to the country, this is why we all have to tighten our belts right now, right?
And who's in the vanguard is going to step up and say, I'm going to run for office. I'm going to eschew power. I don't want a lot. I want to bring power back to the states, back to the people. We need to reconcile all these imbalances. We're going to have a severe recession/depression. Vote for me.
But that's my point. Like, to a large extent, we get the leadership we deserve, right? We get the folks that we elect. Like, we have to start demanding more accountability, more restraint, more responsibility. And until we do, we're just going to get more of the same.
And which one of our two candidates, lead candidates, would fulfill that role?
Well, I don't think we're dealing with a bumper crop of great prospects here, my friend. No. But again, if we as a populace just toss up our hands and sort of just abdicate the future, then why should we expect anything different, right?
Yeah. That's one of the reasons why I love coming on your channel, because you, I don't know what religion you are, or if you're not religious at all, but you're doing God's work, if you don't mind the expression, because you can affect change with your platform that is growing very rapidly and deservedly so, I might add. So maybe in some small way, Adam, we can make a difference.
Well, when you made the very accurate comment about who even understands and has an interest in discussing the financial issues we're talking about here, I agree. It's a sadly small percentage of the populace, but hopefully it's growing slightly by the efforts of you and I and other people in this space to try to do it. And of course, through the efforts of the viewers of this channel who put this stuff into practice and help, you know, educate others based upon what they learn on channels like this. Well, Michael, it's just always such a joy and privilege to talk to you. Thank you for, again, coming on, sharing your passion, your expertise, and also just fully, you know, sharing your portfolio positioning with us. Super appreciate it. For folks that enjoy it as much as I do, would like to follow you and your work, or perhaps talk to you about working with you and your firm, where should they go?
So the website is pentoport.com. I also have a midweek reality check podcast. It's $50 a year with a 5-week free trial. If you have $100,000 to invest and you're a U.S. citizen, I will manage your money directly myself using the IDEC portfolio. And we are, you know, long stocks right now, but we have one eye towards the emergency exit door. And we're ready to pull the eject button when the when financial conditions and my own proprietary index tightens enough. And we're going to do exactly that. So we'll follow the data wherever it leads us and continue to pray for this once great country.
Great. Well, you're a good man. And I want to underscore one thing about what you just said, which is despite your long-term concerns, you are not in a hide in the bunker, sell all your possessions, go live out in a silo somewhere. You know, you still see opportunity to navigate capital. It just requires really close looking at market conditions, looking at what your model's telling you. So I don't want people to feel like in any way we're trying to sort of scare them out of their assets. We're just telling people hopefully more of the rules of the game, and so that they can navigate on a more informed basis with the opportunities that still lie out there.
In deflation and depressions, you want to have the four horsemen of the economic apocalypse. You want to short stocks. You want to be in short-term bonds. You want to have cash. You want to own the dollar. In stagflation, like, you know, would you short the Zimbabwe stock market? Or even in Weimar Germany, stock prices go higher because they're priced in the local fiat currency. So, you know, it's just about knowing where to invest on the yield curve, knowing when to short bonds, knowing when not to have any bonds, knowing when to own overweight commodities, knowing when to overweight high volatility stocks and when to underweight them. So, you know, or bond and bond proxies, when to own them. So it's all about that. It's not about scaring anybody. It's about trying to provide a real rate of return for your clients, no matter what the macroeconomic conditions.
Very well said, sir. All right. Well, folks, look, if you've enjoyed this discussion with Michael, would like to see him come back on the program the moment his model tells us that there's a new chapter of this game afoot, please let him know by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Just a reminder for all things Thoughtful Money, and as you know, Michael has done a really good job of underscoring here, navigating what's likely to come ahead from here. You know, for the vast majority of people, you want to find yourself with a good financial advisor. Perhaps it's Michael. Perhaps it's one of the firms that you see on this channel with me week after week at Thoughtful Money. But again, highly recommend that you, if you don't have a good financial advisor, you find one soon to be your financial quarterback. And if you do have a good one, great, sit down with them and say, hey, look, just listen to this discussion with Michael Pento. He raised a lot of, you know, big questions. You know, how are you positioning for these things? Make sure that you're very clear with whoever is managing your money on how they're managing it for you. If you want to schedule a consultation with one of the ones that Thoughtful Money endorses, just go to thoughtfulmoney.com. You fill out the form there. You'll be contacted by one of those advisors. Also, if you want to get our free newsletter, that's where you go as well. Just a quick update too, our new MacroPass service, which you've heard me mention on this channel the past couple of weeks, we keep getting new people signing onto it. We just got Michael Howell from Capital Wars. He's now agreed to join the participating faculty. So that service, which is available to our premium newsletter subscribers, just keeps getting better and better by the week. All right, Michael, well, look, as we wrap up here, I've got one last question for you, which is you're a highly successful man, learned a lot in life, both through your career and just through your you know, unique journey. What's a What's a big career lesson that you've learned that you think is worth imparting to the audience here, whether it's from a mentor and maybe what they passed along to you, or maybe it's something that the School of Hard Knocks, you know, beat into you along the way. But what's you know, one of the big lessons you've learned in the arc of your journey that you think is worth sharing?
I'm going to say that don't be overconfident in your own abilities. Always be willing to learn, no matter how old you are and how many years experience you have. You know, in anything you want to be great at, whenever you stop learning, you just stop getting better. So I would say that. And then I would also add, you know, it's always beneficial to reach back when you reach a certain level. Always good to reach behind you and pull somebody else up with you. Yeah. And I think investing in people is even more important than making money. So those are my two responses.
I think those are great. And on that last one, look, if we want to build a better tomorrow, you know, we have to bring up the people that are going to create it, right? That are going to be there after taking the torch from us. And kind of like to your point earlier about how few people either have the financial literacy or the interest in financial matters to really understand the type of stuff that we're talking about. A huge reason for that is because we did a terrible job of teaching financial literacy in our school system, right? So like we, you know, it's up to us to make sure that those we care about are brought up to a position where they've got the capabilities to then do the things that we would like to have done in the future. And if we're not doing that, then in many ways, we're kind of already committing the future to it being a future of less. So I love those sentiments, my friend.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Well, look, Michael, it's always just a super joy and privilege to have you on. Thanks so much for coming on. Look forward to having you on again soon. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
Thank you, Adam.